So, speaking of the Friday Forum, and that's what I'm speaking of, I attended yesterday's and got a recording of that. Maybe I'll try and excerpt a bit of Michael Metz, Radicals in the Heartland. He's got a book out on U of I Press, and I got a couple signatures copies of it. So at some level of donation, beyond the $40 membership, I haven't decided what it would be, you can get this book. He's going to be back in the area. He graduated here. He was the founder of an early underground newspaper. I guess that's what they called them in the days. It was called The Walrus. The time has come for many things to talk of many things of cabbages and kings. I think that's where the Walrus line comes from, just talking of the things that people don't talk about. Michael Metz is his name, and the book is Radicals in the Heartland, and it covers the U of I student movement. There was some spirited debate about nuance and attitude. A lot of people from that era, including myself, were at the forum. There's no way to capture all of the input, but I'm going to try and include some of the voices of the community speakers. All right, I'm turning the mic down here momentarily. Readjust. See, you didn't even notice that. Got Mumi Abu-Jamal on Venezuela. I actually haven't heard this yet. He's pretty good about not using words that aren't on the radio. This is a commentary that I play regularly to kick off the show. Political prisoner Mumi Abu-Jamal. It's a cause celebre around the world. People investigate it know that he at least should get a fair trial, and there's some movement on that. Amy Goodman's got one about the Sackler family and the settlement in that regard. All the deaths caused by that particular scourge. And I'm having a little trouble getting to my first segment. So perhaps instead of that, I'll mention the number again. 359-9338. Actually, it'd be better if you called when I didn't have the mic open. And I don't have anybody on board here to... Blues Master Dave Daubert was in the house a moment ago, but I think he's out the door. And, well, a lot of people come in and volunteer their time. You can do that, too. There's probably some way you could fit in and help out if you got more time than money in your situation right now. We understand that it isn't the easiest time for many folks. But please give what you can. You can arrange a payroll deduction through a variety of means, but the combined charitable campaign is in the fall, but you can always arrange the payroll deduction. Just takes a little more, not even a little more work, but it's not the time when people are doing it. It can be arranged if you can give more, if you take it out paycheck by paycheck. We would really appreciate that, to have that cash flow guaranteed in the... you can always turn it off when you need to, too, if something's changed in your circumstance. Speaking of taxes, if you want to give us a little of your tax refund, maybe you're still working on that. Usually, if you're getting the money back, you work it out early. Anyway, the Mueller report. I've got two things that I listened to in preparation for the show. One of them would have required a lot of editing. That was with Aaron Mate on the show Moderate Rebels with Max Blumenthal and Ben Norton. I recommend it to your attention. They're really snarky, and they use a lot of filthy non-FCC-approved language. I only had to bleep two things out of the commentary between... Jeremy Scahill with Naomi Klein, who is Canadian, but now women's studies at Rutgers. Been in the U.S. quite a bit, and perhaps more than she's lived in Canada these days. I don't know. Shock doctrine and what is to be done. That's not her title. That's somebody else's. Matt Taibbi, who writes for Rolling Stone and had a piece that I skimmed. I should read it thoroughly, but he's going to be talking some of his points about Russiagate. He lived in Russia during the Yeltsin pillage era, when the U.S. was doing what it could to get some of that largesse that came out of the privatization of the communist state, if it was communist. They're in bed with oligarchs. Many banks are. It's not just Trump. Trump's sort of a buffoonish caricature of money laundering. And he ought to be gotten on that. He should have been gotten on that when Felix Sater went state's evidence many years ago at the time of the Trump Soho problem. Anyway, so that's going to be... Ali Abu Nima, who's with the Electronic Intifada, and what may be being redacted out of the Mueller report are the things about collusion with Israel. That's one of the main things that the 2 weeks National Security Director, the one that didn't last long, the one that was talking on unsecured lines, unencrypted phone calls. I can't remember his name. He was known for shouting lock her up at the Trump rallies. They didn't get any hard time, did he? Anyway, here's Mumia on Venezuela, and it's already 7 minutes in. 359-9338 is the number to dial. I left a lot of space to pitch, but I hope to not have to do it too frequently by getting a couple of people on board. Had some phone trouble the other day when I was on Wednesday hosting the rebroadcast of the Friday Forum. The Michael Metz talk will be on this coming Wednesday, and I'll try to break it up in segments so I can do some entreating. It's a long-standing rebroadcast of the Friday Forum, and Kathy Kelly and Father John Deere, who I thought was defrocked, but I don't know. Details to follow. Here's Mumia from Prison Radio.
Venezuela, again. Several years ago, during the early days of Hugo Chavez's presidency, U.S. forces supported a coup attempt against him, and the barrios of Caracas exploded in support for the former military officer. The people of the capital came forth demanding his immediate release, and Chavez was released. The Americans, of course, denied involvement, but everyone knows otherwise. Latin America has seen the bloody paws of the American Empire, and they've seen it for the better part of a century, and it has never been pretty. More recently, the New York Times has reported that the Trump administration has been in contact with Venezuelan generals, and they try to get them to betray their country's government. The White House denied it, but everyone knows otherwise. Maduro, Venezuela's elected president, is at heart a Chavista, for he admired his old boss, President Hugo Chavez, and he cherishes his memory. Don't believe for a moment claims that the U.S. government cares about the Venezuelan people, for we need look no further than America's colony called Puerto Rico. After hurricanes and storms ravaged the island, the White House called them ingrates after they demanded help from their brother Americans. Trump threw paper towels at them. This is true. And he denied them any kind of real support. They were left to swim or drown in the face of a natural catastrophe. May I remind you that Puerto Ricans are Americans, and American citizens, no less. No matter. For when they needed help the most, they found they were on their own. You think they care about Venezuelans when they don't give a damn about Puerto Ricans? Does that make sense? A leopard, they say, cannot change its spots. An empire cannot change its ways. Thank you all. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Well, I'm going to pull that down because I need to start up the next segment and get to the phone call. Keep that phone ringing. Well, they just gave up, so Prison Radio, regular feature here. You can go there and find stuff out about his possible retrial and how it was looking really good, and then the radical DA just elected in Philly succumbed to pressure and is appealing the ruling that would have allowed him to have a retrial. Yeah, sorry I missed that call. Please call back if you were thinking about a pledge. I don't know if I can take any informational calls to speak of. Maybe when I'm playing the longer segment about the after Mueller from The Intercepted, where, of course, one of the co-founders, Glenn Greenwald, is being still pilloried for being skeptical, and I think skepticism was warranted. Aaron Matei, as I mentioned, was the guest on this other program, Moderate Rebels, that would take a long time to make airable on FCC authorized radio, but you can find him, Moderate Rebels. I recommend it. If you were expecting a lot from the Mueller report, these guys were paying attention to stuff that was going through the going into the memory hole, Orwellian, I guess, might say. Aaron Matei came up in Democracy Now, and he has some constructive criticism of Democracy Now, how she was even taking lines that were pretty much sort of talking points from, Adam Schiff. I mentioned the book, Radicals in the Heartland, the 1960s student protest movement at the University of Illinois. Michael Metz, who was, like I said, one of the co-founders of The Walrus, which was an early underground journal in 65-66. He lives out west, got a Cisco job. There's pictures in here I hadn't noticed from the era, including John Lee Johnson in his youth. Used to be on, in fact, he initiated the name Higher Ground for the show that precedes this show, News from Neptune, which has been around a long time and is in obviously a new format, and people might know if you search for it, find a lot about the video one, which I have no idea what they're doing. And, enough said. Amy Goodman on the Sackler opium. Maybe this is a good riposte to all of the preoccupation with the Mueller. This is about life and death and pain. Amy Goodman had a good segment, actually, on Democracy Now!, and she used the last segment to talk about the flip side of preoccupation with opioid. What about the people that really are, as one of the persons folded up in a car wreck and need pain relief in extreme ways, like my father did in his battle with throat cancer at the end of his life. There's always the pendulum swinging the other way, and some people that need the relief are finding it harder to get that palliative. So that wasn't the bulk of the show. And she had the guy on that wrote the book on Sackler's family fortune through whitewashing OxyContin's complications, if you will. It's already 10:15. Haven't had a pledge yet, unless that was a call that was interrupt us. I should recruit some folks to come down for the tomorrow at 5 and answer the phone, and I should sign up for a couple of shows myself. I meant to get into the Courier this week, but things come up. That might be a thing to do if you are interested in WEFT and don't have some money. You come down and answer some phones, hang out a bit. It's an open scene, if you will. It's a lot of complex things going on in media, as is evidenced by some of the critiques we'll hear in the Mueller. That's at the macro level. At the micro level, there's a lot of stuff going on, too. But here's Amy Goodman's commentary, Breaking the Sound Barrier. 359-9338.
The opioid epidemic hits hard in Indian country. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Drug overdoses killed 700,000 people in the United States between 1999 and 2017, and more than two-thirds of those deaths were the result of opioids. This week, the state of Oklahoma won a landmark $270 million settlement against one of the world's largest manufacturers of prescription opioids, Purdue Pharma, owned by the Sackler family. While the Sackler name doesn't appear on Purdue's pill bottles, it does adorn many prestigious museums and academic buildings around the world. Aggressive marketing of Purdue's products, including its signature addictive drug, OxyContin, made billions of dollars for the Sacklers, some of which they gave to places like the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the Guggenheim Museum in New York and the Tate Museums in London. Now the tide is turning, thanks in part to legal action like the one in Oklahoma. The lawsuits against Purdue and the Sacklers now number close to 2,000, and creative protest campaigns at some of the museums that the Sacklers have funded. Meanwhile, the opioid epidemic has continued to grow, expanding from prescription opioids like OxyContin to include heroin and now fentanyl. The epidemic knows no boundaries, affecting people across class and race lines. But as the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention notes, two of the leading risk factors for becoming addicted to opioids and potentially dying of an overdose are living in a rural area and being poor. Native American reservations in the United States meet both criteria. It's no surprise that the opioid epidemic has hit indigenous populations especially hard.
I think the number one disease that our people suffer from is anonymity or invisibility.
That's Stacy Boland, citizen of the Sault Ste. Marie tribe of Chippewa Indians and CEO of the National Indian Health Board, speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
You're looking at very vulnerable populations of people, very vulnerable healthcare systems that are funded below 50% of need.
According to the CDC, drug overdoses among rural Native Americans and Native Alaskans between 1999 and 2015 increased by 519%, more than twice the national average. That number itself is likely too low, as Native people are often miscategorized ethnically or racially. The Oglala Lakota Sioux tribe in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, has filed a federal lawsuit against Purdue Pharma and several other opioid manufacturers. The devious and corrupt business practices detailed in the complaint are staggering and reminiscent of the tactics used by the tobacco industry in order to deceive the public about the harms posed by cigarettes. The suit alleges Purdue and the other companies, quote, intentionally flooded the market with opioids and pocketed billions of dollars in the process, repeatedly making false statements designed to persuade both doctors and patients that prescription opioids posed a low risk of addiction.
This threat to tribal communities across the United States, not just in South Dakota, is really an existential one. We're talking about some of the most strained economies in the country, where you'll see unemployment rates of 80%.
That's attorney Brendan Johnson, representing the Oglala Sioux of the Pine Ridge Reservation and a number of other reservations. He was speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
What is different here is that tribes do have a seat at the table, have been very aggressive in their claims, because oftentimes the state and the state attorney generals, too often the tribal communities are forgotten. And here, that won't be the case.
As this case and close to 2,000 others make their way through the courts, people are taking action against Purdue Pharma. Artists and activists in New York City lined the Guggenheim Museum's famous climbing spiral walkway, hurling into the vast atrium thousands of fake prescription pad pages bearing messages critical of the Sacklers. The action was inspired by a statement from the 1990s by Purdue co-owner Richard Sackler that the launch of OxyContin would be, quote, followed by a blizzard of prescriptions that would bury the competition, unquote. Artist Nan Golden, one of the protest organizers who herself had been addicted to OxyContin, tweeted after details of the Oklahoma legal settlement were announced, quote, the Sackler family paid $75 million in the Oklahoma settlement today, which admits their culpability. By the way, that's only 0.2% of the $35 billion in profits they made from OxyContin, unquote. To date, the Guggenheim and the Tate Museums, as well as Britain's National Portrait Gallery, have stopped accepting Sackler family funds, and other institutions are considering doing the same. As the Sackler family name is stripped from elite art institutions, appearing more frequently in court proceedings, they must now answer for the ravages of the opioid epidemic from which they so handsomely profited. The anonymity they enjoyed, hiding behind Purdue Pharma, must end. But the anonymity of their victims must end as well, those who've died and those who, addicted to opioids, still struggle to survive. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Okay. Well, a couple of regular callers almost exactly at the same time when I close the mic, and I put one off who lives in town. Thanks, Stuart. We'll catch up sometime. And my arborist friend, hope his fruit trees are blooming at the right time this spring. Ken out in Saybrook. He's got one of the books, and I only got two. There's some possibility I might get some more, and there's also some anthologies by media analyst Robert McChesney that they do a series of. I'm looking to see if I can get one of those maybe for next weekend. And looking for a Flint Taylor book. I've been awaiting that book for a while. Been playing material. He was on Amy Goodman. He's with the People's Law Office in Chicago. Had an office just down in the neighborhood where Fred Hampton was assassinated, and that was one of his first cases. Welcome to Chicago. And then he's had a long struggle with the Chicago Police Department, and nobody should really sympathize with them over this Jussie imbroglio. I think there's some stories that are untold, obviously, but my sympathies don't go out to the CPD for their valiant effort, since all of the baggage they have, which includes torture by John Burge. And you can draw a line between torture and Vietnam. Burge came back from Vietnam with skills, and he implemented them in Chicagoland. And one of his main antagonists, and the CPD's antagonist, was this Flint Taylor. So looking to see. I wanted to mention it again just because I hadn't in a while. You can find a good interview with him on a recent Intercepted as well. All right, I forgot the time on this. I'm going to spit it up a little bit. There's some natural breaks going from guest to guest, Naomi Klein being the first one. The commentary at the beginning is about 12 minutes long, and it's worth hearing. It's Jeremy Scahill's assessment of After Mueller. I excise the humorous beginning because it has lots of expletives in it. It takes the Shawshank Redemption soliloquy by the actor whose name is escaping me. I can't remember either of the leads in it. I'm not a film guy. But it, let's say it has to do with the manner of the escape and what they dealt with in the escape. Enough said. All right, here's Jeremy Scahill with Naomi Klein, and then Matt Taibbi and Abu Lahod. I'm getting it wrong now. He's a Chicago resident and is with founded the Electronic Intifada. I'm just realizing that Taibbi is Lebanese extraction, and the other guest is Palestinian, so disenfranchised and subalterns or marginal people. Sometimes they look closer at things, it seems to me. Don't accept the commonplaces. All right, I'm really spinning it here. 359-9338. Be happy to give another signed book from Michael Metz, Radicals in the Heartland, the 1960 student protest movement at the University of Illinois. And there, in the fall, in October, there'll be a conference which they're trying to make 3 or 4 days long. UVI Press is behind one of the days. Okay. 359-9338. I did say that recently, but I'll be saying it a lot.
I'm Jeremy Scahill, coming to you from the offices of The Intercept in New York City, and this is episode 88 of Intercepted.
This American carnage stops right here and stops right now.
On January 20th, 2017, Donald J. Trump took power as President of the United States. He had openly campaigned on carnage. He ran for president promising to give the rich more, to bring back torture, to wage a war against immigrants, and to build his wall. He was gleeful in pledging to make America's healthcare system even worse. He promised to bring back torture, to fill Guantanamo back up, to kill the families of suspected terrorists. He said he would ban Muslims from entering the United States. He encouraged police to be more brutal, has given aid and comfort to Nazis and white supremacists. He openly promised to wage war against women and their bodies, to pummel the environment, to benefit the already ultra-rich. He is corrupt to the bone, has been for a very long time, and he's proud of it. He brought into his inner circle a dangerous cabal of neo-fascists, white supremacists, and more recently, neoconservatives.
Is among the worst violators of the UN Charter and UN Security Council resolutions, perhaps indeed the worst violator, it is truly an outlaw regime.
If you cross us, our allies, or our partners, if you harm our citizens, if you continue to lie, cheat, and deceive, yes, there will indeed be hell to pay.
And on Russia? For all the talk of Russia collusion and Trump being an asset, Donald Trump has dramatically ratcheted up official hostilities with Russia. Look at the ongoing attempted coup against a key Russian ally in Venezuela. The Trump administration's arming of Ukrainian forces with lethal aid. Trump's open threats to massively retaliate against Moscow if they interfered with Trump's bombing of Russian ally Bashar al-Assad. Trump hectored Angela Merkel and Germany over their purchase of natural gas from Russia. Trump has imposed sanctions, expelled diplomats, on and on. Trump has been pretty damn hawkish on Russia, despite all the absolutely questionable behavior and constant lies about his discussions with Russian figures or people attached to the Kremlin, and his public comments about Putin and his meetings without notes. But as commander-in-chief, Donald Trump has been as hawkish, if not more so on some issues, than his predecessors.
I don't have a bad personal relationship with Putin when we have conversations. They're candid, they're blunt, oftentimes they're constructive.
And now we come to this whole Russiagate matter. We do not yet have Robert Mueller's report, and Attorney General William Barr is a shady character. He was a key player in covering up the Iran-Contra scandal and getting pardons for some of the key criminals involved with it. But it would be an unthinkably brazen move, even within Trump world, for William Barr to just whole cloth misquote Robert Mueller when he says that Mueller determined that there was no collusion, no criminal activity by Trump and Russia to interfere in the 2016 elections. So now we have this saga dragging on, and the Democratic chairs of several key House committees seem intent on continuing this investigation regardless of what the Mueller report says.
They can't indict the president. That's their policy. And therefore, there could be overwhelming evidence on the obstruction issue, and I don't know that that's the case.
No, but we know there was collusion. There's been no indictments, we don't know. But let me say further. We know a number of things. We know what I just said. We know that the president pressured the FBI to go easy, to stop the investigation.
This much is clear. This has been an utterly colossal media failure, and it reveals how little things have actually changed with the broader press since the Iraq war lies. The overall tone of much of the reporting on this Trump-Russia story has started from the position that the intelligence community was being truthful about Trump and Russia. The reporting then sought to further confirm those assertions. It was confirmation bias to the nth degree. The starting point should be, to quote I.F. Stone, all governments lie. That's the biggest common denominator between the Iraq war media failures and the ones we've seen here with Russiagate. Also, the fact that Trump is a cartoonish, buffoonish villain contributed to an atmosphere where the attitude was that anything Trump was accused of, no matter how insane it sounded, was totally plausible, if not likely, if not certain to have happened. Trump was not supposed to win. It was Hillary Clinton's turn.
And tomorrow, let's make history together. I'm Hillary Clinton, and one last time, I approve this message.
Instead of unpacking why Clinton lost to this reality TV host and known corrupt crook, a narrative was promoted by the most powerful political and media actors in our society. This was a Russian plot. Putin stole the election. Trump is a Kremlin agent or asset. It resulted in neocons hugging it out with Democratic strategists and CNN and MSNBC hosts. George W. Bush is now our buddy, the friendly little painter. And isn't it cute how he passes mints to Michelle Obama?
So we're together all the time, and I love him to death. He's a wonderful man. He's a funny man. And it was a simple gesture.
This whole circus also included scores of former CIA, FBI, NSA, DNI, other alphabet soup veterans openly waging information warfare on cable news and as unnamed sources in print stories. But we were told this time, the CIA is on our side. The CIA is telling the truth. Robert Mueller is going to save the Republic from the orange menace. No, those institutions are and remain what they've always been. And it was a grave media sin to believe otherwise. Every time former CIA Director John Brennan appeared on cable news, it looked to me like information warfare, like an actual CIA propaganda campaign, filled with mysterious references about how he has secret knowledge of what Robert Mueller was really going to do.
And I don't think Robert Mueller will want to have that dramatic flair of the Ides of March when he is going to be delivering what I think are going to be his indictments, the final indictments, as well as the report that he gives to the Attorney General.
We've been subjected to more than 2 years of nonstop, fact-free assertions and wild theories masquerading as fact, masquerading as insightful analysis. We have been repeatedly told that it was the beginning of the end for Trump. And there were tens upon tens of millions of dollars spent on this spectacle. Thousands upon thousands upon thousands of hours of congressional time and energy was poured into proving the conspiracy theory that Trump is a secret Bolshevik operative being run by Putin.
Right, we're told that President Trump has tried to arrange the summit so that at one point in the summit, it will be him and President Putin in a room with no other Americans. There won't, as far as we understand, maybe not even an American translator there. So if President Putin were hypothetically in some sort of position where he could give orders to an American president behind closed doors, no other American would ever know what those orders were.
And this is how major news organizations and powerful connected Democrats and former spies and government agents chose to spend the past 2+ years?
On Monday, the entire world witnessed President Trump cower in the presence of Putin. I sadly beseech President Trump to apologize to the American people for his disgraceful, dangerous and damaging behavior with Putin.
What is perhaps most remarkable is that while telling us that Trump is the most serious threat to U.S. democracy ever, many Democrats have supported some of the worst aspects of the Trump presidency. They've given him unchecked mass surveillance authorities, supported his bloated war budget, backed his criminal policies on Israel, supported his ongoing attempted coup in Venezuela, and on and on.
At some point, I would imagine things will change, but we really haven't done the really tough sanctions yet. We can do the tough sanctions, and all options are open, so we may be doing that, but we haven't done the toughest of sanctions, as you know.
If the Mueller report says what William Barr says it does regarding no collusion with Russia, it will amount to a massive gift for Donald Trump. It might actually help Trump win again in 2020. That is unconscionable. And anyone who views Trump as a threat to their existence should be furious at the Democrats, the so-called intelligence community, and many of the most high-profile journalists in this country. This is going to be celebrated among the MAGA crowd like it's the second coming of D-Day. Statues are going to be erected. We're going to see Civil War reenactment-style performances about the great hoax against Trump that failed.
The Mueller report was great. It could not have been better. It said no obstruction, no collusion. It could not have been better.
Who's going to pay a price for putting us all in this position? Who is going to pay a price for aiding and abetting Trump by pushing this conspiracy theory? If history is any indication, probably no one. And that's a devastating commentary on the political class and the broader media in this country. We have a jam-packed show today. Coming up, we're going to be talking to journalist Matt Taibbi, who's been calling bullshit on the broader Trump-Russia narrative from the beginning, as well as Ali Abu Nima of ElectronicIntifada.net about the undeniable rock-solid case that Trump and his inner circle did in fact collude with a foreign power, Israel. Why don't we talk about that? Well, maybe the fact that many top Democrats are right now worshiping at the altar of AIPAC and support this collusion openly and gleefully.
Thank you, AIPAC. I'm here to pay my respects. Thank you for the honor of joining you this morning. Thank you for your leadership. May God bless Israel.
We're also going to take a look at what Steve Bannon has been up to, as well as the foreign election influence scandal you may not have heard of. It involves a member of the Bush family dynasty and China. But first, I wanted to check in with my Intercept colleague, Naomi Klein. She is, of course, the author of The Shock Doctrine, No Logo, This Changes Everything. More recently, she wrote the book No Is Not Enough, about resistance in the Trump era. Naomi Klein, welcome back to Intercepted.
Thanks, Jeremy.
What's your reaction to the way that this Russiagate story has been covered?
My first reaction was that this is what happens when you have cable news decide to react to the first reality show president by turning themselves into a reality TV show. You know, if there's one thing that we have to give Trump credit for, it's that he understands how to get ratings using a reality TV formula. That is a gift that he has. Immediately after the election, this narrative that he was a stooge of Russia and that there was this cloak and dagger, Tom Clancy style mystery to uncover was so good for ratings, especially if you plugged it into this reality TV show formula of constantly teasing the reveal after the commercial break, that millions of people got addicted to it. It represents a massive abdication of responsibility to cover stories that were in front of us, that were glaring, that required huge amounts of digging about corruption, about conflicts of interest. for this very dangerous presidency. And I just couldn't help imagining what would happen if these news networks practice real journalism. The responsibility for that failure is something that is really incalculable, like in terms of what it's going to cost us, what we don't know in terms of how this has benefited Trump, who was vulnerable on so many fronts that were right in front of us that we didn't need the conspiracy theories for. If we could have just waited and let the investigation do its work and then report on the findings, they could have built a stronger case for impeachment just based on corruption.
I was wondering what it would look like if we drew a Venn diagram of journalists who got it right about Iraq and WMDs and journalists who got it right in terms of real serious skepticism to the claims of powerful Democrats, the intelligence community, Hillary Clinton, and these cable news hosts, because it seems like there are two camps, if you break this down in a very generic way. There were the people that hyped and swore that the overarching story is true and that Mueller is just on the verge of, you know, indicting Donald Trump for treason. And then there was another track of this where there were reporters, many of them independent journalists, that were really critically analyzing every incident that took place, every new action, every new court filing, and rejecting through fact the overarching allegation that Trump is a bought and paid for Russian asset. And even Michael Isikoff, who was part of promoting the Steele dossier's findings at the beginning of this story, in the past few months has really started to take shots at the way that this is panning out and the way that it's being covered, whether it's by BuzzFeed or other large news organizations.
Right. And I mean, I think that we have to talk about the business model at play here. You know, what were the incentives in place that prevented journalists at these cable news outlets and other outlets from exercising real integrity? But the idea that you would invest everything in this one overarching story, that's what I think we have to really probe. And it has come at such a tremendous cost, including the fact that we know that Trump is a bought and paid for asset of the Trump Organization, and that there were so many stories that were one day flashes in the pan that deserved to be amplified on cable news. And they just weren't, because they didn't fit into this sexier and more addictive story that was also the story of salvation, right? The story that you were going to get saved by this report off in the distance, that there was just some kind of escape hatch, which meant that you didn't have to do the more labor-intensive work of actually trying to speak to the people who voted for Trump and make the case for why he was a complete fraud, why he had betrayed his base. And, you know, there was this moment of sort of mea culpa after the election where people, you know, at news networks said, look, you know, we made a mistake. We were too attracted to the ratings. We couldn't take our eye off Trump, and we handed him the presidency, right? And that was supposed to be some sort of a wake-up call. And far from being a wake-up call, the business incentives at these news organizations are such that they just doubled down, right? And they decided to throw in with the Trump reality show. Who's getting voted off this week, right? Who's being indicted this week? It followed exactly the reality show formula. And it was incredible for ratings in the same way that The Apprentice was incredible for ratings. It just wasn't news.
Right. And it occurs to me that the Democrats, after that humiliating defeat where the chosen one, Hillary Clinton, did not assume power, that they've now added insult to injury by completely mishandling the first 2 years of this incredibly dangerous administration and handing Trump an incalculably valuable propaganda asset that he's going to use on the 2020 campaign trail. And I think some of these Democrats, if Trump wins again, really need to be confronted with the role that they played in making a second term for this guy possible.
That is what is so scary about this moment. If you want to talk about it being a stolen election, talk about the Electoral College, talk about all of the much more significant systemic rigging that is going on. These are things that are actually in the political realm. Unlike this strategy, which is just so flat out dumb to put all your eggs in the basket of an investigation that you have no control over. It represented this synergy between a corrupt political party that didn't want to look at its own complicity in betraying its base to the extent that people stayed home, did not have enthusiasm for their candidates, and in some cases went over to vote for this dangerous clown Donald Trump, and a news media that could not give up the incredible addiction to Donald Trump ratings. And when we have seen aberrations from this formula, like when we've seen Chris Hayes decide to, you know, go to the border and practice real journalism and show the American people what is happening with family separations, we see the real political change that that can lead to. But it needs to be sustained. It needs to be sustained. It needs to be on the news every single night. It can't be an aberration. Well, once in a while, you go out and practice journalism, and the rest of the time, it's this talking heads reality show. You just can't. In my view, it isn't too late. We are fortunate that there is a new generation of politicians in Congress who, while they believe in holding Trump accountable and putting impeachment on the table for crimes that we know about, that don't require any conspiracy theories, that are in plain sight, that violate the Constitution because of the Emoluments Clause and this blatant self-enrichment, you know, more importantly, they're also advancing an alternate political vision of Medicare for All, of the Green New Deal, which is making an offer to people, right? Because we always knew that this could not be another election that was just an anti-Trump election. And that underlies as well a lot logic of, you know, investing so much in Robert Mueller.
Naomi Klein, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Naomi Klein is my colleague at The Intercept. She's the author of many books, including most recently, No Is Not Enough.
Well, I do want to get this on, but I still have only two regular donor folks out there who've gotten on board. 359-9338 gave away one book, Radicals in the Heartland, Michael V. Metz, 1960s student protest movement at the University of Illinois. It's a paperback from, it's an e-book too, so if you want to find it another way, but donate less. Got somebody in at $120 or so, taking that away. Like I said, I'm looking for some more books like that, and should have had them already in hand, but got these and autographed by the speaker. Again, there's going to be a conference in October trying to go over that era and actually also look forward to student activism that was part of what Naomi Klein was excited about there. Looks like we might be able to do this. Next segment is, again, very provocative. Turn it over to them right now. This is from the 84th edition of The Intercepted from The Intercept. They have their problems too, as everyone does in media, in speaking. Looking for some SAIC material. There's not much out there. I'll talk a little bit on the outro if I have a little moment for that, between 5 and 6 tomorrow. Scientific applications in international computing is what it supposedly means, but it's CIA backwards, and Bobby Inman and Robert Gates, all of those people have been on the board or CEOs, and it's a very spooky corporation that nobody really talks about much. In fact, the magazine article, the $8 billion mystery, and Vanity Fair by Bartlett and Steele still stands as one of the few substantive articles, in my opinion. I think they got the kibosh put on them, too, after that article. So, all right, back to after Mueller.
...is quite interesting. As Barr reports that Mueller did not find any evidence of the overarching allegation against Trump regarding Russia, another major foreign influence campaign is being openly celebrated. Not just by Trump and Vice President Mike Pence, but by some of the most powerful Democrats in Congress. I'm talking about Israeli collusion. Now, what is clear to anyone with eyes to see is that the U.S. government openly colludes with Israel all the time. It's a bipartisan staple in Washington, and that's what we're seeing this week at AIPAC.
We are joined this week by leaders on both sides of the aisle, on both sides of the Capitol, because support for Israel in America is bipartisan and bicameral, relentlessly bipartisan.
But more directly relevant to the Trump-Russia scandal is that there is an abundance of evidence that Donald Trump's campaign and some of his closest allies and advisors were actively colluding with Israel to push for war against Iran. There were secret Trump Tower meetings in 2016 with Israeli hackers, Blackwater founder Eric Prince, envoys to the Emirati royals. There was General Flynn and his conversations with Sergei Kislyak that amounted to colluding with Russia. But that collusion was in support of Israel's position and an effort to undermine Barack Obama. We're going to get into all of this and more with my next guests. Ali Abu Nima is founder of ElectronicIntifada.net. They have been reporting for months on an Al Jazeera undercover documentary looking at the Israeli lobby and its connections to U.S. organizations and individuals. This film was targeted by the Israeli lobby before it ever came out, and they reportedly pressured the Qatari government not to allow it to be aired. The parts of this film that dealt with the United States and organizations in the U.S. was indeed never broadcast by Al Jazeera. Now, Al Jazeera denies that this pressure played a role in the decision not to air this investigative documentary. Electronic Intifada obtained excerpts of this banned film, posted them on their site, and they have since posted the entire film online. Ali Abu Nima joins us now. Welcome back to Intercepted.
Thank you very much.
And we're also joined by Matt Taibbi, the journalist for Rolling Stone, author of several books, including I Can't Breathe, about the killing of Eric Garner in Staten Island by the NYPD, and his latest book, which he's publishing in an interesting way, sort of on a rolling basis. It's called Hate, Inc. The latest chapter in that book is called It's Official, Russiagate is This Generation's WMD. Matt Taibbi, welcome back to Intercepted.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Matt, let's start with you. What we've been witnessing since Barr released his summary of the Mueller investigation is Trump declaring that he's completely vindicated. We have the question of this obstruction and how that's going to be handled, the question of obstruction. But on the specific thing that Trump has most been passionate about, you know, no collusion, no conspiracy, it does seem as though Robert Mueller said, yeah, actually, Trump was right about this. And then at the same time, you have people continuing to push like theories that there's still some secret indictment or that Mueller still is going to save us. But talk about what you think were the biggest media failures in this whole saga.
The big thing, the key moment was the first couple of weeks of January in 2017. There was a sequence of events in which we hear that the intelligence chiefs, Comey, James Clapper, John Brennan, Admiral Rogers, they all meet with both President-elect Trump and Barack Obama. They hand them the Steele report, and then almost instantaneously, every news agency in Washington, I'm sure you heard the rumors about this almost right away, right? Mm-hmm. Every reporter who's in the business suddenly heard about this thing that happened. And as a result of that, it gave everybody a hook to write about this piece of private unconfirmed research.
CNN has learned that the nation's top intelligence officials provided information to President-elect Donald Trump and to President Barack Obama last week about claims of Russian efforts to compromise President-elect Trump. The information was provided as part of last week's classified intelligence briefing regarding Russian efforts to undermine the U.S. elections. I've been working on this story.
Now, any good investigative reporter, you have to be concerned about, there are some red flags there. Like, why was this effort made to disseminate the information in this particular way? Why did they have to create a news event to get this into our hands? I was highly suspicious of that. One of the reasons was because I knew some people on the Senate Judiciary Committee who had investigated some Wall Street characters for releasing information in a similar way. And we spoke about that, and they said, this reminds me of that. The whole rollout of Steele and the mania that followed, to me, was the beginning of the entire mess, because it was the implied context for years of stories.
Ali, one of the things that I think is going to be really interesting, if the Mueller report is, you know, made public in whole, which I hope it is, I'm really curious what Mueller has to say in that report, if anything, about the August 2016 Trump Tower meeting with Israelis, Eric Prince, George Nader, people from the Emirates, where they were talking about Iran. You know, all of these people that were at that meeting in one way or another desire regime change in Iran or war with Iran. And that's like almost never talked about anymore. But it really does seem as though some of the most criminal activities or the actual collusion centered around trying to go to war with Iran or support Israel's agenda.
I think you're referring to a meeting that included the CEO of a now defunct Israeli private intelligence firm called Psi Group.
Yes.
That has been revealed to have, you know, been engaged in spying on and intimidating Americans who are critical of Israel. And this company had been brought to Donald Trump Jr. that they could help his father win the election.
The scope of work the Trump campaign considered included the creation of fake online identities to help the Trump campaign manipulate voter sentiments during the GOP primary against Ted Cruz and ultimately against Trump's general election opponent, Hillary Clinton.
It's unknown if this was implemented. I think it's known that the Trump campaign did not agree to go along with this, but it's unknown if this was carried out, you know, secretly on behalf of Trump. And so, yes, it will be very interesting to see if there's anything that about that in the Mueller report. But this, you know, is an example of the kind of activity, secret activity, that is also documented in the Al Jazeera film.
You're talking about this Al Jazeera documentary about the Israeli lobby and influence campaign in the United States, correct?
Correct. This is a documentary, an undercover documentary that was made by Al Jazeera during 2016. It was completed in 2017. And Al Jazeera actually got an undercover reporter hired as an intern at the Israel Project. And he was able to record video and audio from meetings with some top Israel lobbyists and got them to admit on camera or on audio that they were coordinating activities to spy on, smear, and sabotage the lawful First Amendment activities of Americans who are critical of Israel and support Palestinian rights.
Tony read the Israel Project's annual report, which described TIP's mission as building an echo chamber for pro-Israel information. That means using the media to amplify and repeat TIP's messages, as well as what the report describes as neutralizing undesired narratives.
But what happened with the Al Jazeera film, it's called The Lobby USA, is after it was completed, it was simply buried. Al Jazeera never broadcast it. It turns out what happened was that this very same Israel lobby put immense pressure on Qatar, which of course funds Al Jazeera, to suppress the film. Imagine if this had been a film on supposed Russian interference or Chinese interference or Canadian interference in US politics at this level.
Matt, what we've seen, and this isn't new, I mean, this really became in vogue post 9/11 to have former generals and former CIA, former intelligence people just constantly on the airwaves. I mean, this has been going on, you know, all the way back through network news, where you would have on your military analyst who was a general or a colonel. But then it, you know, explodes, becomes an industry unto itself after 9/11. The Pentagon starts having all these generals and military analysts come in for secret briefings with Donald Rumsfeld and others, where they're giving them talking points that they can then use without disclosing that, or disclosing that they're on the boards of weapons companies making all the money. And they're constantly on the airwaves. But in this particular case, it sort of graduated to a different level, where you had people like John Brennan, who was just the CIA director, like right before this all happened,
right.
James Clapper, a whole slew of CIA people, you know, the generals are still there. But all of these people who are career spies have spent their entire careers working in the world of America's secrets. And, you know, we're doing the things abroad that you will never know about so that your children can, you know, sleep safely. The role, though, that they've played in this, having someone who was the former director of the CIA stating on television that he has information.
I thought at the time that there was going to be individuals who were going to have issues with the Department of Justice. Yes, and I think we've already seen a number of individuals who have been indicted, either have pled guilty or have been convicted now.
It felt like we were on the other, on the receiving end of a psychological operation. That's what it feels like to watch cable news when these guys are on.
It was definitely remarkable, and especially the situation with Clapper and Brennan, because these two people occupied a very important role in this story. And they transitioned from being sources to being basically regular guests and analysts on these networks.
But also Trump took away their cushy little security clearances, which I supported. You know, yeah. I think Trump sometimes does the right thing for the wrong reasons. But they also, they became combatants in this story, and they were using the veneer of being independent analysts who had worked in their whole careers in intelligence. They were combatants in this, and they were using their paid positions as contributors to do it.
The decision to revoke his security clearance is, in Brennan's words, an attempt to scare and to silence others who might dare to challenge him. Reference to the president there. With that in mind, the White House has released a list of 9 other former and current officials in the intelligence community and the Department of Justice whose security clearance, we're told, is now under review.
One of those people is James Clapper, the former director of National Intelligence, current CNN national security analyst, and former director Clapper joins us right now. Thank you so much for being with us. And
the idea of kind of getting into bed with these people and treating them as, you know, sort of on our team is a complete anathema in my mind to what this profession is all about, right? We should always be at arm's length. And one of the things that happened with the story was we completely closed off one whole avenue of inquiry, which was about the origin of Russiagate. Why did it start? You know, there were hints here and there. The New Yorker did the story about how Robert Hannigan and at the GCHQ in Britain, he comes to Brennan with a stream, what they call it, a stream of illicit communications, and Brennan is so shocked by this that he delivers it to the FBI, and that's what kickstarts the investigation. They never tell us what those communications are, and they never specify exactly what's going on there, and it's all very mysterious, right? Like, nobody's really nailed down the origin story. And part of that, I think, is because Brennan and Clapper and all these ex-officials have become significant sources for all the main news organizations. I mean, I happen to know a couple of sort of big front page stories where one or the other was the main source. So none of the reporters are going to cross these people. So yeah, that's a very troubling aspect of this whole thing. Like, the lines have been blurred between sort of the watchers and the watched at this point.
You know, Margaret Sullivan wrote a column in the Washington Post on Monday where she was sort of defending print journalists in particular. Is there a distinction worth drawing, though, when we talk about the way cable news covered this? And I'm thinking particularly of, you know, Rachel Maddow, obviously, you know, is probably exhibit A in sort of hyping this constantly, or, you know, Glenn Says Lying every night to millions of people. Chris Hayes, though, you know, had on Jonathan Chait.
Chait lays out what could be considered the worst case scenario for Trump-Russia collusion, that Donald Trump has been a Russian intelligence asset since 1987.
That ridiculous story saying that Trump was has been a Russian asset since, you know, 1987.
Which he got from a Lyndon LaRouche leaflet published in 1987.
Rest in peace, buddy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But on that issue, I mean, do you think, I'll start with you, Matt, is it fair to say, yeah, there was actually a lot of really good reporting on this story and there continues to be really good reporting, and that cable news is just like on another ridiculous level?
See, I don't buy that, because if you're artificially narrowing your scope of inquiry and the parameters are Trump is guilty of something, let's find out what it is, right? Let's not publish any information that's dispositive to that. So if we do an investigation and we find that there's no evidence that there was a link between Trump and this Russian group or that Russian group, we'll publish it if we do find it. We won't publish it if we don't find it, right? That happened multiple times in the story. But also, again, getting back to the other thing, the whole idea of how did the investigation start? There's other things, just the whole idea of The Steele report being in the FISA warrant, the Steele report being in there with the Michael Isikoff story that used Steele as a source. Like, that's, to me, a serious impropriety. Nobody picked that up except the Washington Post to debunk it. I get what they're saying. They're, you know, they weren't as ridiculous and they weren't hyping up the fear factor the same way that the cable stations were. But they had, a real duty of care here to look at the entire picture and, you know, test everybody's hypotheses about this whole thing. And they didn't do it. They only looked at one side of the story, one narrow side of the story. And that was a major, I thought, dereliction of duty itself.
Ali, what about that? What do you think, for instance, of the New York Times coverage of the story from the beginning? I mean, was it responsible? There are some really serious, good reporters that have worked on this story for the New York Times. Is it fair to sort of say all of the major news organizations got this epically wrong?
I think it is fair to say that, with the caveat that there were occasionally good stories, or from time to time, a journalist who did a reasonable story that you could point to. But the big picture is actually, I think, the role of the establishment or supposedly respectable media, like the New York Times, the Washington Post, and NPR, has been to launder bullshit and make it look respectable. NPR is one of the worst. They take stuff that is totally unproven or has even been shown to be false, and they assert it time and again as if it's just uncontested fact. So the thing that you will hear almost every day on NPR is that Russia interfered in our election. And there's never any questioning of what that supposed interference amounted to, who was really behind it, when did it happen? Did it happen before the election or after? And did it have any impact? They never questioned that. They just asserted. The New York Times is doing these big flowcharts showing, how many Russian citizens met with Americans. I mean, just complete garbage, all being used to manipulate people. Max Blumenthal has called it a psyop. And that's what I think it is. Psychological warfare to keep telling people there's something there. And well, if the New York Times is saying it, if the Washington Post is saying it, if NPR is saying it, it must be true. What we know is that it was just a few internet troll farms that amounted to nothing, really nothing. Not a single vote was affected. But the big picture narrative that I think millions of people across the country still believe is that Donald Trump is in the White House and Hillary isn't because of Russian election interference. That big picture narrative, which is totally false, is still intact, and that's thanks to the so-called establishment media.
I totally agree, and I just sort of wanted to point out, the New York Times did a story last year. Scott Shane, I think, did this story about New Knowledge, this group that turns out they were faking Russian influence operations in Alabama. The New York Times had done a series of stories about, supposed Russian troll activity getting involved in things like the Parkland shooting, where one of their sources was New Knowledge. Those stories still exist. They're still up in the New York Times. In other words, the Times, even the Times knows, they've done a story on these people. They know that there's a factual issue there. And rather than take the logical next step and ask, whoa, what the hell is going on here? Like, why are people faking Russian troll activity? And why are these people being commissioned by the Senate? Why would the Senate still have a relationship with these people after it's been discovered that this went on? The whole idea of reporting, in Hamilton 68, which is this group that was sort of shadowy group that was created by the Alliance for Securing Democracy. Glenn has written about this. It's sort of a neocon Democrat alliance, right? And they create this dashboard that supposedly tells us in real time what Russian trolls want us to, be freaking out about. Well, if you call them up, they won't tell you what their methodology is. They won't tell you what sites they're monitoring exactly, right? Or how they're doing their computations. And yet, they became the source for front page stories on these major newspapers of record. And the aim of these stories was exactly what Ali was talking about. It was to legitimize the most insane, the most crazy parts of the manias that went on during this period.
We've had Robert Mueller portrayed, particularly by Democrats and liberal media, as this man of impeccable character. And he's just like completely ruined their Christmas by apparently saying there was no collusion. But the long-term consequences of the way that the broader intelligence community, the FBI, Robert Mueller have sort of been lionized or placed on a pedestal by many, many political actors in our society.
Well, the long-term consequences of that and this whole Russiagate diversion was that we've lost 2+ years to build a real principled opposition to Trump. Trump should be opposed for the correct reasons, not because of totally bogus claims that he's a Russian puppet. Someone else commented about this, that all that energy that we saw in the first days of the Trump administration, when thousands of people spontaneously went to the airports to protest the Muslim ban, I was among them. I was at home in bed and I was seeing on Twitter people are gathering at O'Hare Airport. And I got out of bed and drove to O'Hare Airport to be with people, and it was incredible. That was happening across the country. People were hungry to be motivated, to be galvanized, to be given a mission, a principled mission to fight for the country they wanted to live in. And instead, the Democratic leadership took them on this wild goose chase. And how do you get back from that now as we head into the 2020 election, where the Democrats seem incapable of learning? At least I'm talking about the leadership and the establishment and where the money comes from, because The alternative to this failed approach would be to give people real policies, to say healthcare for all, housing, paying jobs, a real progressive agenda that meets people's needs. But of course, the Democrats can't and won't do that because that's not where the money is for them. And so they retreat into this flag-waving nationalism to out-Republican the Republicans. So I wish I could be more optimistic.
Ali Abunima, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Matt Taibbi, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Matt Taibbi is a journalist with Rolling Stone. His latest book, which is being published on a rolling basis, is called Hate, Inc., like Hate Incorporated. The latest chapter is titled, It's Official, Russiagate is This Generation's WMD. And Ali Abunima, he's co-founder of the Electronic Intifada. That's an independent online news publication focusing on Palestine. He's also the author of The Battle for Justice in Palestine and One Country, a Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse.
Okay. You know, they really don't talk that fast. They do talk fast, but they don't talk that fast. But I wanted to get that all on, and it kind of worked out when the commuter clock just turned 11 o'clock, so it's time for Behind the News.